Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of March 13th, 2017. Today we're joined by our frequent guest, the prolific commentator, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Doing well. How are you doing?
Good. As always, D.R., wonderful to have you with us. Mm-hmm. So, D.R., on March 5th, not so long ago, a week, 10 days ago, the Massachusetts Climate Action Conference had Massachusetts Climate Action Network had its annual conference in collaboration with the Toxic Action Center over at Northeastern University. And it was a great day. It turns out there were more than 500 people there, which was really an uptick. A lot of people there, great seminars. I guess I kind of wanted to talk a little bit about what I saw as kind of one of the overriding takeaway things that I came out of it. So the morning keynote speaker was a woman named Candy Mossett, who is a Native American extraction from North Dakota, came to talk about fracking. She's not immediately in the Standing Rock orbit of things, right? It's a different place she comes from. But she gave a keynote speech that was remarkable for its description of the way the fracking industry has impacted certainly the Native American your quality of life, I guess. I mean, mm-hmm. She went through a rather interesting kind of description of the history of the reservation that she is on and how it was slowly, you know, it was agreed to be a treaty as a sovereign nation and then was slowly chipped away and reduced by factors of 10 down to now it's a pretty big place, a million acres or something. But even there, it's cut into a patchwork because sometime in the 30s, they said that private people, non-Native Americans, could own land inside the reservation. So now the reservation property is turned into a kind of a checkerboard with outside farmers and inside farmers. And then recently, the fracking has begun to happen and how destructive it is in the sense that there are these huge trucks that go through all of the little, of course, these are small places, right? You're out in a you can imagine sort of a North Dakota reservation, not a very built up place. Trucks rolling through the man camps, the arrival of heroin, the violence between the Native Americans and the whatever the oil guys are, whatever you call them, right? But all the hustlers that go into the boomtown, you know, how you could stand there in one place and turn in a 360 turn and see gas flaring everywhere around the horizon, and how little regard the fracking industry has for the Native American inhabitants of the reservation, and that how it is continuous with the same kind of treatment that has been going on since the 1850s, right, when the place was established. Yep. It really makes a strong case for the kind of environmental justice sympathy for that. And it puts the Standing Rock protests in a much clearer light, a much more credible historical context, right? Mm-hmm. Because this is not just something that came out of the blue that a bunch of Native Americans decided to stop the pipeline. I mean, this is a very, part of a much bigger pattern. So it was really quite moving. Mm-hmm. I mean, the phrase I ended up with was in my head was sort of this, the intimate violence associated with this fracking thing that comes in and destroys the local community, which, of course, as she was saying, in the 1930s, they built a dam across the Missouri River, flooded the lake back up into the reservation, and pushed all the Native Americans off the most arable land near the river. So now they're up on the uplands, which are drier and stonier since the 1930s, trying to eke out a living. And now this next thing comes through to impact. So it's really, it was quite touching, I think, the whole presentation. Yeah. And then I guess I don't have a good quality, recording of Candy Mossett, so I can't put that up. But I did happen by chance to listen to a podcast. The title of the podcast series is My History Can Beat Up Your Politics, which I thought was an intriguing title. But the particular one I listened to was about basically the takeover of Alcatraz Island in the middle of San Francisco Bay in 1969 by Native American activists who even at that time were trying to raise their own self-awareness. And basically the guy draws this arc from the 69 through the 70s to the 80s, and he finally ends up at the Dakota Access Pipeline. But again, you see that what's happening now in a much more modern American context, and not some sort of weeping Indian with feathers in his head looking over trash, right? Like you saw from the commercials in the 60s. It's very interesting. Very interesting. So there was that at the conference. And then the other main speaker at the conference was a woman named Lori Gibbs, who happened to be one of the main activists associated with one of the people who was most immediately and initially impacted by the Love Canal thing. Now, I don't know if you even, were you even alive when Love Canal was around, DR? Or was that before
your time? I
think
I was only about a year old when that story broke.
I mean, for those of you of such a tender age that you may not realize it. I mean, Love Canal was someplace up in upstate New York, Buffalo or someplace, and they'd put these horrific chemicals into a ditch and walked away. And then they built a housing development right next to it. And the kids were all sick, dying of cancers, all kinds of, and it took a long time for the people to finally understand that this Love Canal thing was a terrible toxic disaster that was getting into people's homes. And she had to go through, this woman described the effort they had to go through as activists to get the attention of anyone, right? And of course it all echoes back to climate change people, right? You feel powerless. You say, oh my God, you know, no one's listening to me. And Lori Gibb would say, well, okay, if they're not listening to you, go get in their grill and make sure they hear you, right? Don't back down.
Exactly.
It's so there was that. So it was all a very interesting conference. I mean, lots of good workshop sessions. One of the interesting workshop sessions was led by our own Carol Oldham, who's the executive director of MCAN. And I have some tape of her that I will put up in a separate podcast. But basically what she was talking about was a program that MCAN is working on, which offers to people who live in different towns in Massachusetts essentially a checklist for you to look at your town government and grade yourself and your community on how advanced you are in terms of getting to clean energy. And then once you've done that, that's the logical first step. Then you can, you know, with the help of colleagues and whatnot, you can begin to take action. I mean, it's like that initial step. If people are confused and don't know what to do, want to do something and don't know what to do, here's this checklist. This is a way at least to go look around and say, gee, there's no, absolutely zero solar panels in my town and nobody cares, right? And you're at one level. On the other hand, you might already have solar panels on the school and there's some sympathy for this and now you're at a different level and you can grade yourself and figure out what you want to try next.
You can think of it as thinking globally and resisting locally.
Yes, absolutely. Think globally, resist locally. Now, it was it was a pretty good day. I'll put up a link to another a podcast called Sisters of Resistance, where one of the women doing that had attended the conference, and she also discussed her observations because she went to several other sessions. You can take a listen to that. It's very interesting. I will, if the names of the people in that podcast sound familiar, well, there you go. I'll let you figure out what's going on.
Exactly.
But there you go. So that was the MCAN conference this past week, DR. Tell me, in terms of the environmental justice questions facing the world, I heard somewhere that somebody at EPA made some move recently to try and make a statement?
Yes, according to Inside Climate News, the head of the Environmental Justice Program at EPA has resigned after 25 years. Mustafa Ali, who helped to found the Environmental Justice Office in 1992 during President George H.W. Bush, he has resigned out of disgust with the reported gutting of the Environmental Justice Unit. There is an expectation that the Trump administration will plan to, via budget cuts, essentially dissolve that Environmental Justice Unit. As he leaves, he's trying to urge Scott Pruitt to sort of, you know, use whatever influence he has to try to rescue the Environmental Justice Unit. But obviously you can understand Mr. Ali's high level of skepticism that Pruitt will in fact do such a thing.
Oh yeah. Yeah. No, people leaving the EPA in reaction to the statements and actions of Mr. Pruitt, that's a telltale thing. People have committed mm-hmm. their lives to the EPA and they get this kind of a reaction.
Mm-hmm. And they just have to be heartbroken because they see what on the inside, what everybody else sees on the outside, that this is an attempt to sort of permanently injure, if not outright effectively kill the EPA.
Yeah.
And I think it was Myron Abel of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. I think he was quoted in one of the sort of thehill.com or one of these newspapers, basically saying that the idea of what they're planning to do is to sort of damage the EPA to such an extent that even if there's a changing of the guard in the White House in 4 years, whoever then comes in can't really rebuild that which has been destroyed. So the idea is to essentially basically to cause the EPA to implode, essentially.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm a news junkie, so I see more than is good for me. But a couple of weeks ago at something called the Conservative Political Action Convention, CPAC.
Mm-hmm. CPAC, yep.
Conservative Political Action...
Conference.
Conference. Anyway, they had, Grand Dragon Steve Bannon speaking in front of... And he was saying that they're explicitly trying to destroy...
They didn't call the administrative deep state.
The administrative state, yeah.
Yes,
not the deep
yes.
state. That's a different buzzword. But the administrative mm-hmm. state. They want to destroy that, ruin it, and change mm-hmm. it and level it across all kinds of barriers, right? The Department of mm-hmm. Education and all these things. They want to destroy the administrative state. Mm-hmm. And so this is an ideologically driven war on the part of these people, right? They have this mm-hmm. idea in their head that things like the EPA should not exist because mm-hmm. they're bad, presumably bad for democracy, they would say, right? And they mm-hmm. must be destroyed. And it is, so don't think this is random, right? What Scott Pruitt's doing.
Indeed, or to paraphrase the famous Marco Rubio line, let us dispel with the notion that Pruitt doesn't know what he's doing. He knows exactly what he's doing.
Yeah. I mean, one of the other sort of topics related to environmental justice came up in a broadcast on NPR within the last 2 weeks. But mm-hmm. it turns out that out in California... which has a cap and trade program in place. There was a report that some disadvantaged communities were not supportive of the cap and trade law. And the argument was that while the benefit of the cap and trade law benefits everyone, certain disadvantaged communities, in particular ones that live near refineries, see no change in the local consequence. I mean, there's still poisonous soot everywhere, trucks driving through their communities, no diminution of that. Mm-hmm. And the part of the California cap and trade deal, I guess I should say, is that companies can, quote unquote, offset their carbon emissions by... doing good somewhere else. That is to say, mm-hmm. if you burn a lot of fossil fuels, but you say, oh, I promised to plant an equivalent number of trees up in Oregon someplace, you're good to go, right? That is you've mm-hmm. offset your emissions. And the people in this report were arguing that that's just fundamentally unfair, right? They mm-hmm. still have toxic dust on their cars from the trucks in the local refinery. And what the heck is California's cap and trade doing for them? Mm-hmm. And I think it's a reasonable question to wonder. I completely think that putting a price on carbon is an important thing to do, but you keep coming back to the question of how do you do that fairly? And we need mm-hmm. to listen to the voices that say it's unfair in certain circumstances and try and manage that, right? Did you say anything about that, dear?
Exactly, and it was a great piece in NPR regarding that issue, and it does raise the question, you know, with regard to the issue of offsets and try to sort of make up for pollution in one location by trying to sort of green another location. Why don't they offset their pollution by cleaning up the place where they polluted?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the offset thing is just guilt money, right? It's exactly. a way to cheaply, you know, game the system. I mean, so I oppose offsets for that mm-hmm. very reason, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, from a global perspective, if the local consequences are bad, but the global consequences are good, mm-hmm. right? How do you square that circle, right? Because exactly. you know, I mean, it's a topic that has to be continuously discussed because mm-hmm. no one's saying, even though I call each week for a price on carbon, mm-hmm. it's not a simple thing to do, and we have to figure out how to get there.
Exactly, and we've discussed before how issues of equity have sort of bedeviled issues such as cap and trade in carbon taxes and carbon pricing. That, you know, the idea is how can things be done equitably? How can things be done in such a way that they do not further disadvantage already disadvantaged groups or already disadvantaged individuals? Mm-hmm. And trying to calibrate that is sort of the great challenge of our time.
Right. I completely agree. I mean, but that's what we're here for, right? Mm-hmm. We want to plant the seed in people's head to think about how would you put a price on carbon yet not, you know, screw over a set of people that have been screwed over too many times already, right? Mm-hmm. How do you do that? And we don't have an answer, but once you got a question, then the answer is simple, right? You just keep working exactly. on the question until you get to an answer.
Who knew carbon pricing could be so complicated?
Nobody knew carbon pricing could be so complicated. Nobody knew. But I tell you, when we get that solution, it's going to be great. Trust me. All right, DR, let me see. We'll have to tell everybody that we'll put up links to most of what we talked about at the blog. It's at massclimateaction.org/blog. And, of course, we're on Facebook. If you click in there, share us, you click through to the blog and listen to the podcast there. That's /massclimateaction. You can listen to us directly on your smartphone using Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Overcast, Podbean, SoundCloud, and a bunch of other places. And, of course, you can find us on iTunes. You can subscribe there and get us that old-fashioned way, huh? So we'll mm-hmm. close where we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it is our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the reckless policies of the new administration not be accepted as normal, and that the United States put a long-term and equitable price on carbon. So thanks for being here, DR.
Thanks.
Thanks to everyone for listening. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us, and until next time, be green.
Very cool.